Jellyfish.
Pass the salt, will you?
Pass the salt.
Pass the salt, amigo.
It's time. It's time.
I think they could give us a new name. I believe we are Evan Jellyfish.
Hey, will you pass the salt?
Pass the salt.
We need salt over here.
It's time for Pass the Salt.
Pass the salt.
But we like to share the gospel without any backbone to it, see?
The views, opinions, and seemingly outrageous comments expressed in this program are based on the Holy Spirit leading of a man called Coach.
I gotta ask you this out there, Christian America.
It's time for Pass the Salt with a coach, Dave Dobenmeyer.
Well, you know, folks, I get myself in a lot of trouble. Every once in a while, I'll post on Facebook a meme just every once in a while, just to try to help people remember. And the meme that I put on Facebook a lot is this: at the end of this whole ordeal will be a fake birth certificate. And we are right now in America. We see the deep state, talk about the deep state, everything that's going on with all that. I don't think we have any idea the depth of how deep that state is, the depth of how the interconnectedness of what goes on in the deep state. It's hard to find anybody who will do any type of actual research at all exactly who the deep state is. I often say, like when they just arrested Steve Bannon, how can Steve Bannon get arrested and Hillary Clinton not get arrested? What the heck is going on? And Bill Barr, and he's been in there for 3 years, and they're going to, QAnon tells us they're going to arrest him next week. They got 100,000 of them. They're just going to come load them up on yellow school buses, and they're going to arrest them all. And I'm getting to the point where I'm a little bit frustrated, as many of you are, saying, how about not just justice? How about some equal justice? There was a time in America when we expected our leaders to live to a higher standard, not a lower standard. That's really the battle we're fighting in America today. So I want you to right now just email somebody, or Facebook or Twitter or Twatter or Twitter, whatever social media you're on. Tell them, I tune into Coach Dave Live, because we got Jack Cashel with us this morning. You said, who? Yeah, Jack, that's part of your problem, see. you watch too much Sean Hannity and Fox News, and that stuff's all good, but it comes from a slanted position for sure. And Jack Cashel, I got to know Jack maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, ran into him at an event out in, someplace out in Kansas. And he was writing a book at that time called TWA Flight 800, I think is what it was, and we'll get into all that. But Jack's been on the trail. You know, L.A. Marzulli's on the trail of the Nephilim. That's what L.A. likes to say. Jack Cashel has been on the trail of the Obamas for really quite some time. And he's really unique in that he is, are you ready? An investigative reporter, right? A guy who actually goes and looks at the information, looks at the facts, and says, wait a minute. A connects to B, B connects to C. Therefore, D's probably a reasonable position to hold. So we contacted Jack last week and asked if he'd come and join us here early this morning from the Kansas City, Missouri area. And he just released this week. Mike, if you can pull up his website there, cashhill.com, if you can click on that. Jack just this week released, I haven't read it yet, Jack, be honest with you. I'll get it and I'm going to read it. A new book. An investigative reporter, an investigator called Unmasking Obama. Now, hang on. I hear some of you say, come on, leave him alone already, will you? He's old news. Leave him alone. Well, he isn't old news. And if we really want to try to figure out exactly what's going on, then we have to get back to the genesis, to the root of exactly what's going on. Jack Cashel, welcome to our gathering here of thousands all across America. These guys are all woke, Jack, so you're not going to say anything that's going to shock them.
And, okay, very good, Dave. Thanks for having me. By the way, I'm in New York State, so you didn't get me up that
early. Oh, so you didn't have to get up so early today then, did you? I was feeling bad. I thought you were going to have to get up real early. So, Jack, I'm here, man. I just served you a softball. Just start running with it, man. Just start running with it. And by the way, folks, his website is cashhill.com. Jack has written all kinds of books. Good stuff. But he has been on the trail of the Obamas for quite a while. So come on in, Jack.
Yeah. No. And what I wrote, Dave, is the first actually comprehensive look at the Obama presidency. And what I decided to do, and which I've done throughout my career, is rather than like exploit the work of others, make those others who are doing the boots on the ground reporting the heroes of my story. So in this book, I tell a story of as many as like 40 different citizen or independent journalists who did all the hard work and all the hard digging. And the phrase I use for them is called samizdat, which is the Russian term for this, the underground that worked during the Soviet years to get out real information. Like they're the ones who published the Gulag Archipelago and Dr. Zhivago and all the things that the Russian state obviously would have not ever published, and let alone they might have imprisoned you for publishing it. So the samizdat consists of a whole series of independent journalists. Some of them work for publications. Some of them are self-employed. Some of them are doing it on their own dime. Some are just average citizens. One blogger described them as a coalition of willing Lilliputians. Dave, you and I are Lilliputians in this world. But our coalition succeeded in actually ending the reign of Barack Obama. And you think about the lineup in 2016, because the subtitle of my book is, what is the subtitle? the fight to tell the true story of a failed presidency. And you say, what do you mean failed? Well, here's what I mean.
First of all, you're not some Republican hack, right? You're just looking at this as honestly as you can. So the unmasking of Obama is evidence of a failed presidency. Go ahead, brother.
Yeah, no, and I go after, in my book, the what I call the responsible conservative media, which has no use for people like me. I mean, you know, I'm too irresponsible for them. I've heard that word used, you know? And even though I stick to the facts, and I don't engage in, I don't confuse speculation with reality. You reach a certain point on that food chain and you get rejected. But I tell the story of the people who did the hard work, the trench guys, you know, the people, the Lilliputians. And together, think about this. You come into 2016 and to November 2016, on their side, they have every major newspaper in the country, every network except Fox, and maybe you never can't even trust Fox, every major magazine, all of the social media giants, all of Silicon Valley, all of Hollywood, all of Broadway, and the deep state. And they're fighting a coalition of willing Lilliputians to get the story out. And the Lilliputians won.
Amen.
And now they've been mad for the last...
The upset of upsets, right, Jack? I mean, it was the upset of upsets.
It was.
Nobody saw it coming.
The signs were there because under Obama, the Democrats lost 13 governorships and control of 13 state legislators. They lost 850 legislative seats. The American people were getting their information from someplace other than the traditional sources of information. They were getting it from the samizdat. And from people like you and me, Dave, and your listeners, the people who take a bit of information and forward it on to someone else are part of that samizdat. And that's how they won, using their media. Mm-hmm. Jack Dorsey, who was president of Twitter, said that if he had known that Twitter was going to get Trump elected, he never would have invented it. You know, but it did.
So it did, just because it, for the first time in our lifetime, certainly the little guy could speak some truth and find some truth and find a coalition of people who agreed with him.
Yeah, so, and thanks to the internet, I have as much information at my fingertips as the entire New York Times newsroom does.
Oh, and Jack, do you remember the day when you used to have to go to the library and go into the card catalog and look up? Oh my goodness! Now all you do is just click and boom. Boom, it's right there before us. So, Jack, as we move through this, and we're interactive, so guys are going to join in and ask some questions as well. Let's do this real quickly, Jack. Before we get to unmasking Obama, let's talk about him, about Obama. What have you discovered in all of your research? Because the first thing they're going to say, Jack, is you're a conspiracy theorist, you're a hack. And it's interesting that you said, and I found it to be true, that we fight a battle of containment. The conservative media will let you go so far, but they'll never let you get to the sweet spot. They'll never let you get there. Jack. What is the sweet spot with Barack Obama? What is the real story of this guy?
Well, I tell you, I'm going to give you an example of where the conservative media called time out on me just recently. And that is in one of the revelations in my book, I have, and this is a quote, I have found a letter that Barack Obama sent to an old girlfriend when he was probably about 23. And the letter goes, I'm paraphrasing here, but I probably should pull it up and get it exactly. In fact, if you give me a second, I'll get it exactly. I know, I'll just paraphrase. You can look it up when you get the book. And in the letter, he says, I make love with men every day in my mind, and I hope to become more androgynous and explore more androgynous areas, you know?
you found a letter from him to a girlfriend saying that.
Right. Now, I make love to men every day in my mind. This is in 1983, you know, and when it's before it's even fashionable to say something like that. And a girlfriend, you know, who knows the nature of that relationship, when she knew that letter was so explosive, when she shared it with the biographer David Garrow, she redacted it, that revelation. Then she sold it to Emory University. And then once it was accessible at Emory University, you could go in and see the real letter, as Garrow did. And he shared it with me. Garrow's a Pulitzer Prize winning civil rights historian. I mean, I'm not making this up. And that's the kind of thing that I thought would be very interesting, because it comes right out of his mouth. And then you have the testimony of people like Larry Sinclair. And you go back and rewatch his press conference at the National Press Club. Boy, I tell you what, the guy may be crazy, but I think he's telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And then after the Stormy Daniels stuff, after the Christine Blasey Ford stuff, you think this is fair game. Love is love, right? That's what the science tells us. But our media said, nope, boop, time out. We're not going there, you know?
Why won't they go there, Jack? Why, Jack? What's their issue there, you think?
You know, there is, and with the case of Obama, there is a deep, deep-seated fear of being called a racist, you know?
Yeah.
There's a deep, deep-seated fear of talking about anything that have to do with homosexuality. You know, any of the sensitive points that that on the left have established as no-go zones, Islam, mm-hmm. Homosexuality, transvestitism, feminism, our media, our responsible media, and I'm talking about Fox, Washington Times, gotcha. Wall Street Journal, New York Post. We don't have much.
Rush Limbaugh.
Rush Limbaugh, yeah. Although, as much as I love Rush Limbaugh, there are places he won't go. Flight 800 is one of them. Uh-huh. Then you reach the wall, and then you just have to spread the information sideways because it's not going up and down the chain.
Okay, Jack. So who is this guy? Who is, from your research, who is Barack Obama?
You know, he's a cradle leftist. I discount his Islam, just like I discount his Christianity. They're both religions of opportunism. He became a Christian for the same reason he married Michelle Obama, because it rooted him in a black community. And I do believe Michelle is Michelle, by the way. So.
You believe it's her, huh? You believe she's a she.
But I know the rumors, and you know, yeah. I know Joan Rivers was killed after blah, blah, blah. But Obama's been a cradle leftist from the beginning. His mother was a secular humanist and trained him in that. He grew up under the influence of Frank Marshall Davis, who was a communist and a pornographer and a bisexual with a taste for underage flesh. Just something to consider. Frank Marshall Davis was the most important part of Obama's early childhood education. This is in Hawaii. Now, you guys know this. If I said Frank Marshall Davis in the New York Times newsroom, I'd get people scratching their heads. It was Frank Marshall Davis. They've denied themselves critical information. I would say he's always been a leftist. He's always been a serious leftist, except that, and here's the caveat, he's a lazy, shallow leftist.
Huh.
He is the kind of guy who's, you know, he's like, was it King Henry II who say, someone rid me of these troublesome priests, like you might have said about Trump. But he's not the kind of guy he's not Joseph Stalin. He's not the kind of guy who's riding the wave, you know, who's pushing the chain.
Right,
he's not collectivizing the kulaks.
He's paddling on top of it.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Maybe we should collectivize the kulaks, you know.
Jack, I'm scrolling your website because the stuff that you got is just, you know, the Trayvon Martin stuff. You got all kinds of fascinating stuff on there, right? Let me swim back here, and then I'm going to let some guys come in here. Who and how did Barack Obama get shoved to the top, Jack? How'd that whole thing happen?
How did he get what? I'm sorry.
Shoved to the top. He was a nobody who became president of the United States in like 6 years.
You know, he was your basic turtle on a fence post. When you see him, you know, he didn't get to run his own. There were a combination of factors involved, but, you know, a lot of it was, I cannot find the puppeteer. If there was a sole puppeteer, I don't know who it was. I mean, George Soros is the obvious candidate, but there's no direct link. What Obama always was a ruthless opportunist, a self-promoter, you know? You don't marry someone like Michelle Obama for political purposes without being determined to ascend, you know? Right. He ran for Congress in 2000 and got thrashed. It was really rash of him. In 2004, he took advantage, you know, in his people, his Chicago people were capable of doing this, of unsealing the divorce records of both of his Democratic primary candidate and his Republican candidate, which is how he got elected. And then John Kerry selects him to be the 2004 keynote speaker, and his career was made at that moment. And Kerry did it because they were looking for what Joe Biden said is a black guy who is clean and respectable and neat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was, that's how he ascended. It was a fluky kind of ascent. The Democrats are still, look how desperate they were to find the vice presidential candidate who could be a Barack Obama, like a black light, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't deal with the Stacey Abrams, who's $500,000 in debt. Kamala Harris is the best they could do.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Hey, Mike,
they need to find that candidate that now that they're being held hostage by Black Lives Matter, they have to appease them. And so they picked probably the worst candidate they could pick.
Is he a natural born citizen, Jack?
Here's my theory. And I go back to Occam's razor. You know, the Occam's razor explanation we hear is the simplest explanation is the best. But if you go back to the Latin, and I spent 7 years of studying Latin as a minor classics, it translates like this. The simplest explanation that takes count of all the essential variables is the best explanation. And one variable that most people looking at the subject don't take into account is the sudden exodus of the Dunham family from Seattle to Hawaii in the summer of 1960, the summer before when Ann Dunham is 17 years old. Here's what we know about Ann as a 17-year-old. She was a wild child. She had a fondness for black men. She expressed this to Obama later. She was hooked on this movie, Black Orpheus. Why does a family send the child away in the summer of 1960? Those of us who are old enough to remember us that time know that even if your next door neighbor got knocked up by the neighbor across the street, she was sent away someplace. You know, she didn't sit in the block and have the baby. I believe that she was impregnated on the mainland. I believe that they sent her to Hawaii and took her to Hawaii because it's the one state where she could go and have a mulatto child without total ignominy. I believe they recruited Barack Obama Sr. because he needed a Hapa pregnant wife to extend his stay in Hawaii as a through the INS. And there's plenty of INS documentation that backs that up. I believe that Barack Obama was probably born in February 1961. And in Hawaii, as a natural-born U.S. citizen, essentially, I mean, with a Native American black parent and a Native American mother.
Who we don't really know who it is, right? So really, we don't know who his dad was.
I don't think it's Frank Marshall Davis, personally. I know it's a good theory. I like the theory. It's a plausible theory. But if you take those variables into account, everything begins to make sense. Because if he's born in February, it destroys the whole mythology that he's built his candidacy on. That is, as this multicultural ideal, this child of a multicultural marriage that lasted for 2 years. That's always the story until Barack Obama Sr. was called away to Harvard. Well, here's what we know. We know that he spent the first year of his life in Chaz, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle, you know?
Yeah.
We know that. But if you go to the New York Times newsroom and you'd ask, hey, where did Obama spend the first year of his life? They'd say Hawaii with his father. No, Barack Obama Sr. and the baby Obama never spent a night under the same roof. And Ann Dunham showed up in Seattle in August of 61. She's telling people she has a three-week-old baby because that fits the timeline of having Barack Obama Sr. as a father. The father's a prince or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But in fact, this baby is probably about 4 or 5 months old at the time.
Hmm.
And that, I think, is the best theory. I can't prove it, but it's the one theory that fits all the facts. Then all they have to do is have an at-home birth and then call it in to the Hawaii advertiser, Honolulu advertiser, and say, hey, we had a baby born, you know, yeah. August 4th. You know, which would mean that, you know, by the way, Ann Dunham didn't go to school the second semester at Hawaii. And the accepted narrative, she would have been no more than 2 months pregnant, you know?
So, Jack, we forget what it was like in the 1960s when you got pregnant out of wedlock, right?
Yeah.
You sent them away from home, right? It was the normal thing to do.
Right. I remember, you know, because I grew up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, you know, where, you know, if you got pregnant, you went away.
Yeah.
And also, girls would show up on the block, nieces from Wisconsin or whatever.
Yeah, so. That's right. It does happen. Hey, Mike, real quickly, let's go to Jack's website and pull up all of the books, because I want people, those of you who aren't familiar with Jack, I want you guys to get a little broader view of him. And then, by the way, Jack, we got a lot of guys wanting to ask some questions here, so we're going to open it up and just let you go kind of wherever. But up on the screen right now should be, I mean, I'm not going to make you talk about all these books, folks, but Jack has been at this a long time, man. The Hunt, scroll on, just on down through them, Mike, where we can see all of them. The pictures are slow to pop up. TWA Flight, I got it up on my screen. Maybe I'd be better if I looked over at my own screen where I could see it. So the recent one is Unmasking Obama.
Right, which just came out this week.
Yeah. And it again, Jack, Unmasking Obama is about the fact that it was a failed presidency. Why don't you jump into that for a few minutes?
What I like to do in the book, I like heroes in my stories. So I try to find the person who's fighting the system and make him the hero of the book rather than just exploiting the work they've done, you know, and expanding
right.
the work they've done. So, for instance, in my first TWA Flight 800 book, my heroes were Liz and James Sanders. They were arrested on charge of conspiracy for trying to get at the facts of that flight. If I Had a Son, about
Trayvon Martin
death, the George Zimmerman trial, the people who were doing all the work was some great Samizdat warriors, Sundance and his fellows at the Conservative Treehouse. If you don't follow them, you absolutely should. Sundance is maybe the best investigative reporter in America. They totally deconstructed that case while the mainstream media were pushing this notion of poor Trayvon, little boy with Skittles and iced tea, when in fact he was a half a foot taller than George Zimmerman, a skilled martial artist. He was out of his mind in love with this girl he was trying to show off for on the phone, that he was deeply into drugs and selling drugs, into guns, into burglary. His life had spun out of control because his family fell apart underneath him. It's like so many young black kids, Michael Brown, for instance. And then, you know, so they tell that story. So I made them the heroes in my book. And then in this book, in Unmasking Obama, I take it the next step. I find another hero in that story, and that's Joel Gilbert, a Los Angeles filmmaker who made the Trayvon hoax, which if you haven't seen or read, you absolutely have to.
Oh, my goodness, Jack. I couldn't believe that, man.
And folks, I actually helped Joel. I introduced Joel to George Zimmerman, and, you know, I consulted with him on that project. I every day he'd call Jack. He goes, I got to go deeper. I got to go deeper. I got to learn more. I got to find out who the real girlfriend was. It wasn't just enough to show that the trial witness, the star witness at the trial, Rachel Chantel, was a total imposter, which is the outrageous judicial fraud. But then he went and found the actual girlfriend and interviewed her. You know?
All right, Jack. So again, because I watched that video. It was unbelievable. What was the name of that? Maybe Mike can dig that up for us. Because, man, folks, it was a documentary done on the true story behind Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, we remember all that stuff, the corruption that went on behind the scenes. The narrative that we got was a totally made-up narrative. Right, Jack? Totally made up.
It was a lie from beginning to end, and it launched Black Lives Matter. That's why it's consequential. And it's available on YouTube for free, but YouTube is very, they don't want you to see it. So you have to put it in word for word. It's the Trayvon hoax, colon, unmasking the witness fraud that divided America. If you go to the TrayvonHoax.com, it'll tell you how to get there. It's probably the easiest way to go. But, you know, they about 200,000 people have seen it now. A lot of them are young Black people, and they are angry at being used and exploited because they grew up, like kids who are now like, 20, 25, they grew up thinking of Trayvon Martin the way their grandparents grew up thinking of Emmett Till, you know, the 14-year-old Black kid who was killed and lynched in Mississippi in 55. And yet it was just the opposite.
Well, Jack, it's the exact same thing that we see in all of them, right? It's with Floyd. It's the story we're getting is not the same story.
Right.
They take these stories, they make them up. Michael Brown, we could go on and on and on. They're all made up.
Ends up, don't shoot, blah blah blah. They have become. What's happened over the last 30 or 40 years, Dave, as you've seen, I'm sure, is that the major media used to have some. Respect for the truth. They have none anymore. With the emergence of a conservative media in Islamistan, now they see their job as either defending their guy or attacking your guy. And they're utterly indifferent to the truth. I'll tell you how bad it was. When Joel Gilbert premiered the Trayvon hoax at the National Press Club in Washington, and I went to the premiere, and no single reporter showed up from the mainstream at all, period. And they're only no one from the responsible right showed up either. They're afraid of this. So I said to Joel, I said, the story should at least have legs in Florida, you know, where it all took place. Trayvon lived in Miami. His mother was running for county commissioner. She lost by half a percentage point just last week. And I said, I don't have a vested financial interest in the success of this. And I know the story intimately. I said, let me call. The reporters. Let me call the Miami Herald, you know, the Orlando Sentinel, et cetera. And the conversations I had were appalling, shocking. They don't want to know, you know?
Wow.
They simply don't want to know.
So the left knows that they can lie and they're not going to be exposed for doing so. No consequences for lying. None.
They know that there's a consequence of telling the truth. That is, if you try to tell the truth in a major American newsroom today, like Barry Weiss at the New York Times, I don't know if you saw her resignation letter last month.
Yep.
You're finished. Your career's over. Or the woman at MSNBC, finished. Career over. You know, Cheryl Atkinson is one of my heroes in the book. Yeah. CBS News. She kept getting the CBS News. The head of CBS News just happened to be the brother of Ben Rhodes, who was Obama's chief foreign policy advisor.
Oh, boy.
And the word they were getting is Cheryl's not being reasonable. That was the word they used. She's not being reasonable, you know. And that's what I hear from the conservative media about myself. I'm not being reasonable.
Not being reasonable. Well, Jack, you're with a bunch of unreasonable people here right now. I want to get more into unmasking Obama because I know you're trying to. Folks, listen, I'm going to tell you that I'm not blowing smoke. Any of the books on Jack's website will be eye-opening to you because they are all fact-based. I mean, he just lays out the facts in all of these things, the connections. And this video, Mike, you still don't have the right one up there, unmasking the witness fraud, whatever. That I watched that video. It is unbelievable. The hoax that has been perpetrated on the United States of America, including the fact that Barack Obama was a great president with a great presidency. We'll jump into some of that as well. But I'm going to shut up and let some of you other guys come on in here. Yeah.
It's in the chat real quick. I just put it as a YouTube. I didn't label it, but I think that's the one.
Okay, good. Mark, folks, those of you who have the availability of the chat, Mark Trump just dropped it in there for you. It's fascinating. The girlfriend of Trayvon Martin that they – remember, do you guys remember – I don't know, Mike, if you could pull it up. The girl they put on the stage who couldn't even hardly speak English wasn't the real girlfriend, right?
No, What's amazing, Dave, is that the girl they put up, the real girlfriend, by the way, is a Haitian American hottie. You know, we understand why Trayvon was obsessed when you see photos of her. She was totally self-obsessed. What Gilbert did was he got into the Twitter feeds. He got all of their texts, you know, their Facebook, their Instagrams, everything. And he told the story not only of the fraud, of that is when the real girlfriend, whose name is Brittany Diamond Eugene, 16 years old, she cooperated to a point with Benjamin Crump, who's now the ringleader for the ringmaster for the George Floyd show, to a point of where she's repeating his false narrative about Zimmerman stalking Trayvon, scared Trayvon, run by, you know, no. But then when the state prosecutors came to Florida, she wouldn't go along. She wouldn't perjure herself. And so what they did is they substituted in her 300-pound, mentally challenged 18-year-old sister after they've been telling the world she's 16, right? And what's shocking is they got away with it, you know? They got away with putting her all the way through the trial and wrecking her life. Now, the defense attorneys were being denied discovery every left, right, and center. And then they decided when they saw who the witness was, the girlfriend was, she was such a bad witness, they didn't want to lose her, you know. Right. So they let her go, you know, and Trayvon and Zimmerman was acquitted, except Black America, not just Black America, mainstream America, had been fed all along that Zimmerman was guilty. And so when he was acquitted, they went into shock and they started Black Lives Matter right after.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Jack, I love talking to you. I love all your stuff. Let me shut up a minute. Somebody want to come on in?
Hey, I have a quick question. I was stationed in Hawaii, but learned about Obama. There was the lady that looked at his birth certificate. Then they, Right. She took a flight to another island and somehow the plane crashed after she looked at it. Do you think she was deliberately assassinated?
What's your story on that, Jack?
Well, you know, that's a good question. You know, there's like the show Soul Survivor. Well, she was a soul, not survivor. You know,
yeah.
Which was, I tell you what, sometimes, you know, sometimes reality so mimics conspiracy that you're tempted. I haven't been able to orchestrate a way that she was assassinated. I just don't see the dynamics of how that could happen. Now, I should say, by the way, that when I got into I did a story, a book called Ron Brown's Body. And Ron Brown was the Commerce Secretary who was killed in a plane crash in Croatia in 1996. And when I was offered the contract to do the book, the publisher, I said to the publisher, I said, you have to be able to live with the possibility that plane went up and crashed because stuff happens, you know? And they said, okay, we can live with that. Well, when I got into it, I realized that's not what happened, that plane was sabotaged, that the crash was 99 chances out of 100 was an act of not terrorism, but self-destruction. They had to kill Ron Brown. And they farmed it out to the Croatian intelligence service, which ran the country. I don't think they expected that the killing of Ron Brown would entail the deaths of 34 other people, but that was not an accident.
It was just Bobby.
The Fuddy case, I don't know that I think it was an accident. I mean,
for those of you who don't know, Loretta Fuddy was like the deputy registrar in Florida or in Hawaii. So she's the one who would have seen the real birth certificate, yada, yada. You think the certificate's fake, Jack?
I do think it's fake. I can't prove it. It's not the kind of evidence that you can convince anyone with, you know?
Yeah. There's definitely some questions there. Somebody come on in. A little bit of delay. Well, Jack,
Sheriff Joe, didn't he prove that it was kind of a forged document?
You know, I mean, it gives you the appearance of being forged, but to take that argument into the mainstream is a waste of time. Because
they've already got their narrative written on that one. They're not changing on that.
Yeah.
So, Jack, let's switch gears here a little bit. Then let's get into unmasking Obama, Because man, they still think he's the greatest thing that ever. He was so angry the other night when he did his speech, right?
Yeah.
Get into that book a little bit for us.
Well, you know what the favorite line in his speech the other night was, I thought it was funny, where president should not use the office to enrich themselves, right?
Right.
When he was running for office, he was still struggling to pay off his student loan debts, you know? And now he's worth up north of $40 million, and he's got a $12 million home in Martha's Vineyard, a seaside home, by the way, which means he doesn't really believe in global warming. he is angry because I think he's been, because Trump savaged his legacy. He had a vested interest in getting Hillary elected, not only to protect their shenanigans in late 1996 with the Russia collusion stuff, but also to preserve his legacy, to make believe that Obamacare worked, that the Paris protocols made sense, that, you know, banning, you know, the pipelines were good and all these stupid ideas. And that was all trash. So he's angry, and he's still young. He's not 60 years old yet. He doesn't know what to do with himself. And think about this. This is an odd silver lining to the whole COVID nonsense, is that the people who are hurt most, whose lifestyles were most severely affected, were the rich and famous. You see, because, you know, you and I could fly under the radar, literally, if we wanted to. Now they can't. You know, they've got to walk around with masks, and they can't jet set off to Lolita Island or whatever.
What's your take on that, Jack? What's your take on the Lolita Island?
Well,
you think it's real? You think that stuff's real?
Yeah, I think Jeffrey Epstein was a bad dude. I think that he was. I think Bill Clinton. I know Bill Clinton was there. He took some like 26 flights. There's a halfway decent Netflix 4-parter on it, which is good. I think he killed himself, but I think they let him kill himself. You know. And I think he had enough money to pay off the right people.
Right.
And I don't think it had to come from on top, but it might have, you know.
Might have. Area code 315, you want to come in?
Yes, this is Gary in New York State.
Hey, Gary.
Question, why was, what was it that Ron Brown knew that he was targeted?
Ron Brown knew everything. And when I do my books, I like to find like cooperating witnesses, people who know the real inside story. And in that case, I was very fortunate to get two people to cooperate fully with me, both women. One was Kathleen Janoski, who was the forensic photographer who found the hole in Ron Brown's head at the Dover Air Force Base. And the other one was Nolanda Butler, who was Ron Brown's confidant and mistress. And Brown, at that time, he was essentially the international bagman for the Chinese money-raising schemes. He was so corrupt himself, they had it over his head, and they used him. They really exploited him, and it drove Nolanda crazy at the time because she was, in a sense, his partner, in both in business and in life. And he was, in 2016, he, Nolanda, and his son Michael were targeted by an inspector general for their shenanigans in an unrelated scheme in Oklahoma. His son Michael had two twin babies. And if nothing else, Ron was a good father. He didn't want to see his son go down. So he went to Clinton finally, and Nolanda rehearsed him on this. She talked to him immediately before, immediately afterwards. This is a true story. Nolanda's a truth teller. I never caught her in a fabrication. He went in there and said, listen, I don't care what happens to me. I don't care what happens to Nolanda, but you've got to use whatever political capital you have to get Michael off. Michael cannot go to prison, you know? And Clinton, and he rehearsed this with Nolanda, you know, how he would say this. And Brown was a very meticulous dresser, very fastidious guy. And he gets there, and this is the White House private quarters. And Bill Clinton greets him in his stocking feet. And that just drove Brown crazy. Just thought it was totally insulting. And Brown and Clinton said, there's nothing I can do. You know, I don't have any political capital left in 96. you know, he didn't even think he was going to win the nomination after what happened in November 94. He was in all kinds of trouble for all kinds of shenanigans. The whole China thing hadn't even surfaced yet. It was the dirtiest 2 years in American political history. Easy. Easily the dirtiest 2 years in political history. And so the next thing you know, old Ron's off to Croatia on another trip. He was the bagman. He led these international missions. They were selling seats on these trips. The money went through Ron Brown. And then they were redistributing the money to black churches and black political leaders as walking around money. It was utterly filthy politically. Warren G. Harding, Ulysses Grant, none of those guys had a candle on, you know, could hold a candle to what happened in 1995 and 96. Brown goes to Croatia. Oh, by the way, Hillary preceded him on that same trip on that same plane 9 days earlier, you know, leaving from the Tuzla airport where Brown left them on his fatal trip. The United States had bailed out Croatia not too long ago. Croatia was being run by the Tudjman family. They're a neo-fascist. They controlled both the state and the intelligence apparatus. I think they commissioned the Croatian intelligence to say, don't let him come back home alive. I don't think they expected that plane to go down, but I think they commissioned the hit.
So somebody shot him, and the plane could have just been a happenstance and went, whatever.
No, I think I explained it in the book in some detail. The plane was lured off course into a mountainside. It crashes into a mountain. My best evidence suggests that the Croatian intelligence went there immediately. They misdirected the NATO search out over the Adriatic. The Croatian intelligence knew where the plane went down. They went there immediately. There were survivors. And I think to make sure that Brown wasn't one of them, they just put a bullet in the top of his head.
Really?
In the top of his head. There was one woman who they didn't know was in the plane who did survive, Shelley Kelly. There's a lot of rumors about her. But she did survive, but only for about 12 hours. The Croatian, real legitimate Croatian rescue squads made a serious effort to get her down the mountain. But a storm broke out afterwards. Here's how bad the major media are. The New York Times had a reporter on that plane who died, like everyone else did. And 6 years later, when I went to write the book, 7 years later, I requested the official U.S. Air Force report of the crash. I was the first person in the media to ask for it, right? The New York Times didn't bother to ask for it. And here's another kind of little cute story. It's in Germany, in Wiesbaden. The report is, and it's all in paper. It's 22 volumes. There's no disc. There's no online, nothing. And I said to them, and they said it's going to, I talked to some functionary, said it's going to cost multiple thousands of dollars. It's going to take months to get it to you. And I have a deadline and I don't have the money. So I said, well, listen, I have a summary of the report. I guess I'll have to live with that. Immediately thereafter, I get a email from a colonel, and it says, an Air Force colonel, because they lost six of their pilots on this plane, six of their people on this plane. They said the report will be there in a week and we're waiving all fees, right? A week later, about four UPS guys show up with a pallet, you know, filled with this Air Force report, you know, and it's 22 volumes, there's huge boxes. And I have been working on TW-800 with serious, you know, aviation experts. I gave them the technical data and asked them to decipher it for me. And I went into all the interviews and everything else, and medical reports and whatnot. And I walked away thinking Occam's razor, the simplest explanation here is the best. That plane was lured off course. They went in and they did a coup de grace on Brown by just putting a bullet in the top of his head where you would never notice it. Kathleen Janoski, who was the first to see the body, said there were no other fatal wounds on the body. You know, because he was found some distance from the plane. He was apparently thrown from the plane. It crash landed into a hillside. It wasn't a catastrophic, you know, kind of where everything disintegrates kind of crash. So that's pretty much the story of Ron Brown.
So it's the deep state at work. This is clear back again, folks. And Jack Cashel, author of Investigative Reporter. I love the research that he gets into. And Jack, let me again switch gears again on you. Let's go to TWA Flight 800 a minute, right? Because as I said before we went on the air, James Kallstrom, who was now he's kind of, every once in a while, he'll pop up on one of these shows as a FBI expert and yada, yada. But he was one of the major guys who really covered up what really happened Flight TWA-800. Folks, if you remember that, that was the plane that exploded over the harbor in New York. Just out of nowhere, this thing exploded and killed hundreds of people. And nobody could figure out. They finally went back and said, well, it was faulty wiring, right, Jack? Faulty wiring caused this.
Faulty wiring in the center fuel tank. And I have 100, I say roughly 100 emails from people who worked in center fuel tanks and are horrified. They were insulted by that explanation. I'm going to tell you a funny story, though, to set this up. In the fall of 2016, Kallstrom was showing up regularly on Fox News.
Yes.
Criticizing the Clintons, you know. And he was some sort of security expert, and he endorsed Trump, right? So I had not talked to him to this point. In my book, it came out that summer of 2016. So I got his address from a private investigator friend of mine. I sent him a certified letter, and I said, "Listen, Jim, if you really want to make a difference in this election, come out and let's tell the true story now of what happened with TWA Flight 800." Well. To avoid the election, I went to France. I voted absentee. I didn't want to be there. I live in a Democratic neighborhood. I don't want to be around them. I don't want to hear a horns honking on November 9th. You
know? Sure.
So I am sitting out. This is going to sound much more elegant than my life really is. On the Esplanade in Nice on the French Riviera, right? Mm-hmm. And my phone rings. And I pick it up and it says Connecticut. I don't know who it's from. And I get it, and I had heard that Kallstrom was like a really profane, angry, blustery kind of guy. And I hear the phone, and he goes, "Is Jack Kallstrom?" I said, "Yeah." And it's Kallstrom calling, right? So he would calm down. And then I say, "Hey, listen, Jim, you know, I know you're for Trump, I'm for Trump, you know, you could help out. You know, it's still not too late. You know, the election's still a couple days away." And he goes, then he says to me, we're starting talking, he goes, "Are you going to tell me that a terrorist missile took down that plane?" I said, "No, I'm not. I'm going to tell you that our missiles accidentally took down that plane." And then he goes, "God." And then he goes, he starts cursing. I mean, F bomb. And then he goes, and this is the funny part. He goes, "You sound just like that effing Pierre Salinger who held a press conference on the effing French Riviera saying our Navy took down a plane, you know?" And I'm thinking to myself, thank God I didn't tell him where I was. Because Salinger, if you recall, who was JFK's legendary press secretary, held a press conference in Cannes. I was in Nice, or, you know, 50 miles away. It was the day after the good Democrat. He waited till the day after the 1996 election and laid out the case. He was pretty much accurate. He didn't have good enough control of his information to go public like that. But he tried and they took him down. Oh, man. The New York Times did 4 articles in that November alone ridiculing Salinger. They ridiculed. They ruined his career. They ruined his life. And they sent a message to every other independent researcher in America, don't mess with us.
Keep your mouth shut. So TWA Flight 800 was brought down by an accidental missile launch by the U.S. Navy. Is that what it was, Jack?
Yep. Yep. Just like, you know, we brought down the Iranian Airbus by mistake and just a few years earlier. Was it 88, I believe? Was it 88? Yeah, 1988, I think. Yeah. And we killed a couple hundred passengers. You know, that happens. Accidents happen. Military accidents happen all the time. In this case, you know, the Navy was doing the right thing. They were trying to protect. This is 2 days before the Olympics. They had instituted a new system. They were testing it. They had to test it in a trafficked area. You know, because otherwise it wouldn't make no sense. I mean, they were afraid of, because they had good intelligence that the Al-Qaeda rather was plotting to hijack a plane at the time, to take a smaller plane full of explosives and attack a major American target. That was the Operation Jinka. That was what they were worried about at the time. And so they had to go through these rituals, these tests. They had, you know, we know now we have videos of a practice test 5 days earlier that took down a drone right over the harbor, right? We had the video we have. We got it from the FBI.
Wow. Anybody want to jump in here? Let me open it up here. Yeah, maybe Mark.
Oops. Oops, didn't mean to do that.
That's all right, man. Anybody want to jump in? Good question. Hey, Jack.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not up your maybe it's not up your alley. What about Building 7? World Trade Center.
Who?
Building 7, the World Trade Center. Have you done much investigation into that, Jack, into what really happened?
I have looked into World Trade Center, and I try to stay away from that because I don't see it. I don't see this. I know I looked into Building 7 actually pretty closely. At Building 7, I don't think World Trade Center was an inside job. I don't think it was planned by us or by anyone other than the people who did it. There are anomalies, you know, but when you, and this I need to explain sometimes to people because they don't get this. If you're writing a book and you're getting a publisher, you can't just take a string of anomalies and make a theory out of it unless you have a larger logic determining why you would do this, you know? So there was no logic for us to shoot the plane out of the sky in 1996, but there was a powerful logic for us to cover it up. There was a powerful logic to kill Ron Brown. There was no, you know, and when the people who present theories of, you know, Bush did it, inside job, et cetera, they have competing theories as to why they would have done that. And none of them, to me, hold water, you know? And that's where I start. I start, what's the overwhelm? What's the logic that drives this action? Then you look for parts to fit the logic, but you can't just have parts without a logic, you know?
Right. So Jack, as with Barack Obama, we got about 10 minutes, 8 minutes left here. As a Manchurian candidate, when Barack Obama came into office, what was his purpose, Jack? When he assumed, certainly he wasn't operating on his plans. What was the plan behind the scene to put Obama into power?
You know, I think one of the more compelling stories that I talk about in the book that the major media ruthlessly suppressed was the story of Percy Sutton. And Percy Sutton was a very venerated black New York politician, entrepreneur. He was in his 80s. In March of 2008, he was on a New York City talk show called Inside City Hall or something. And they asked him if he knew Barack Obama. And he goes, yeah. He goes, you know, not personally, but 20 years ago, I was approached by a good friend, Khalid al-Mansour, who is the lawyer for one of the world's richest men, Alawid bin Talal, the Saudi Arabian billionaire. And they asked me if I could help to get this young man into Harvard, because I had connections at Harvard. And I wrote him a letter and that's how it started, you know. And so what happens then is that when that video surfaces, doesn't surface for several months later, this is an incredible revelation, right? That Alawid bin Talal, the guy who tried to give New York City $10 million after 9/11 and Rudy Giuliani rejected because he's an anti-Semite and was blaming Israel for the attack, and Khalid al-Mansour is a raving anti-Semite, had approached this, you know, respectable New York politician. And the major media ignored it, and their what I call the firemen, the people who put out their fires, in the the lesser progressive media, went after the story every which way, tried to savage it. Then I discovered, though, in doing my research, one of the heroes, one of the Samizdat heroes, is this guy in Kalispell, Montana, you know, who's for the Interlake, I think it's the Interlake Journal he's writing for. He discovers a column from 1988, the year that this overture was made. 1988, the year that Obama would have started at Harvard, from Vernon Jarrett, who was the father-in-law of Valerie Jarrett, right, saying how he had been talking to Arab billionaires who were trying to fund money to young black people to get them into college, right? Mm. And so then the same people who attacked Percy Sutton in New York attacked Vernon Jarrett now, you know, who is a respected black columnist.
Yes. Valerie Jarrett's dad, right? Valerie Jarrett's dad.
And now they were both, they had both lost their minds. Neither one of them knew they were talking about it. And what my book is about, Roy, what I'm asking you the book is about the fight between the Samizdat, the real gritty, independent journalist who can't be bought out because I'm self-employed. I haven't made it at a salary in 20 years. You can't take my job from me. Who are telling the real stories, and the major media and their henchmen and the lesser liberal media who are going to whatever lengths they have to suppress those stories. If there is a deep story, it's the story of Alawid bin Talal and people like him pushing Obama through and up to the presidency. That is the story that needs to be told. And I can only go so far as my resources can take me. I can't, I can't get Alawid bin Talal on the phone. And this is where the major media have defaulted, have left us. You know, I read everything they write to know what they know. They read nothing that we write because they don't want to know. But they can make calls. New York Times can pick up a phone and say, hey, White House, we need to talk to you. I can do that and no one's going to answer my call. I mean, so right. There are limits to what we can do. And sometimes I get criticized by people on my own side for saying, oh, why don't you do that? Or why don't you expose that? Because to the degree that I have credibility is to the degree that I say nothing that's false. Because if I say make a mistake on our side, if you make a mistake, they're going to be end zone dancing for the next 20 years on that same mistake.
All right, Jack. So speaking of end zone dancing, we've got about 4 minutes left here. How's this whole thing going to play out here in November? I'm not just talking about who's going to win. What's going to happen in America, Jack, no matter who wins?
I'm going to talk in a metaphor, and I'm going to refer back to a book I wrote called Sucker Punch about the basically it's about the false story of Muhammad Ali. And I went to see the Ali Frazier fight in a theater in Gary, Indiana, the first one, the big one. There were 4,000 people there. And my fiance and I were there. We're about the only two white people in the whole place, which was a terrible mistake on my part. I should have known better. I grew up in Newark. I should have known better. And the hostility towards us, towards Joe Frazier, was palpable.
Right? Oh, yeah. I hated it.
So I said to my wife, we had a couple friends with us, too, and I said, and we were in school then, and we were just being stupid because it was cheaper in Gary than it was in Indianapolis. I was at Purdue, and I said, we're out of here after 14 rounds. Let's get out of here. And they said, why? Why? We're for Ali. Yeah, I was the only one for Joe Frazier. And I said, they don't know you're for Ali. They don't care if you're for Ali. If it's a close fight and Ali loses, you are George Zimmerman. I mean, you're the guy. I mean, they're coming after you. When we come out to the top, this is going to sound long-winded, but it gets to the point. We get out. I said, I talked them at least into getting the top of the aisle, so we're the first ones out. And we're watching the 15th round. If you remember, Frazier just knocks the crap out of Ali. He knocks him literally off his feet. The audience was absolutely deflated. And as we're standing there, before they even announced the verdict, we know what it is, everyone knows what it is now, a guy rushes by me and he goes, Muhammad Ali, my ass, he's effing Cassius Clay, right? They were so deflated that there was no negative reaction at all. We could have stayed till the end. Now, here's what I'm predicting, and this is a very optimistic prediction, barring major vote fraud, which is always possible. They'll be so deflated on November 5th, the rioting will cease.
Okay?
That's an optimistic prediction. I've been wrong before, but I was one of the very few people who bet on Trump in 2016. So,
me too. I was out in front of that. Folks, Jack Cashel, go to cashel.com. Jack, do they want to get any of your books, and they're all great stuff, Jack. Do they buy them off of your website? Where do you suggest they get them?
You know, I hate to say this, but I suggest they go to Amazon because the numbers are what drives sales now,
Yeah.
Drives the media.
So it would help you more if they go to Amazon.
But I recommend everyone else does.
So if they go to Amazon and purchase it, it drives your numbers better and it all helps.
Especially now with the new book out, Unmasking Obama. Yes, they go to Amazon. The other books, it doesn't matter. I'm not selling them through my website. I'm just linking them. But
Jack, can we win, Jack? Can we win?
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
It does.
But it's not going to be pretty. And who would have expected this last 6 months, the stupidest 6 months in American history. Right. Easily. Easily. No second. There's no close second to stupidity.
70 some days to go. Yeah. Jack, I always enjoy you, man. Appreciate you coming. Stay with
me. Thanks for having me on.
Sit there just a second because I know some of these guys got some questions for you.
Okay.
Jack Cashel, cashel.com, Unmasking Obama. A lot of great stuff on Jack's website. Thanks for being with us. Folks, we'll see you tomorrow.